Welcome to Changemaker with founder of Gypsy Tea and social entrepreneur Zina Muzika.
This new podcast is to help you embrace change and experience amazing people and entrepreneurs. We're going to be sharing secrets, habits, and change-making abilities with you so that you can apply them to your life and make a life of your dreams.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzika.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Changemaker. I'm your host, Zina Muzika. I am very excited to welcome Dr. David Hanscom today. He is one of the top orthopedic complex spine surgeons in Seattle. Evolving from his own 15-year experience with chronic pain, he learned to help hundreds of patients become pain-free using a largely self-directed, structured approach, meaning no surgery. Most patients did not require it after they followed his steps. He is the author of Back in Control, A Spine Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. Welcome to Changemaker, Dr. David Hanscom.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be on your show.
I am happy, too, because, you know, really, this is moving for me because, you know, early on, I was, I think, 8 or 9, and my family, we were driving one day, and we got hit by a car, a big van, and my mom's neck just was completely thrashed, and she had to go to a lot of therapy, and nothing really helped, and she had chronic pain from it. And eventually, you know, the doctors just kept giving her painkillers, and then she got addicted to them. And it was harder to get off the painkillers than it was to really deal with the pain. And so this is a really moving and important message you have. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you have come to helping people without meds?
Well, you know, I'm trained at a very high level spine center back in 1985, and I spent 10 years doing very aggressive surgery because I actually thought, like a lot of people, that surgery was the ultimate answer, that if everything else had been tried, the surgery was the helpful thing to do in definitive. But the data came out in 1993 that the success rate for surgery was about 15 to 25% success rate for a back fusion for back pain, and it's a huge operation. And my results were maybe a little bit better than that, but not much. So I just stopped doing the surgeries, and about the same time I developed chronic pain myself, starting in around 1990, and I was really deeply into it until 2003. And I described the last 7 years of being extreme, and I got very lucky coming out of the hole. I was totally in, dark, no hope, just miserable, and could not see my way out of this thing. And it took me another 5 years to figure out what happened, how I actually came out of the hole. But around 2006, I started sharing these two of my patients, and we see hundreds and hundreds of patients go pain-free.
So tell me, so you have been, for many, many years, you've been, so... Okay, so first of all, that's amazing. I gave my mom your book, and I thought, okay, if my mom believes in this and tries it and it works, it'll work on anyone. And she has told me, it's working. I can't believe it. The writing is really good. I can understand it. It's not, you know, I couldn't believe it because, you know, we're looking at, let's see, 30 years of her dealing with chronic neck and back pain. So, so tell us kind of the theory where, you know, you think anxiety or you've actually seen that anxiety is the root of all chronic pain.
Well, I think the anxiety is the root of a lot of symptoms, including chronic pain. And what happens is, if you think about this carefully, your entire body is evolved around avoiding anxiety. So if you're hungry, anxious, you get food, water, air, shelter, etc. So the way the human organism has evolved is basically avoiding anxiety. So it's basically, in my mind, a mental reflex. Something occurs, you take action to decrease anxiety that essentially shapes every aspect of our human behavior, which is the unconscious part of the body. So heart rate, digestion, blood flow to the muscles, to the brain, is all really based around reactions to anxiety. What people forget, when you become anxious, your body secretes adrenaline and cortisol, which affects every organ system in the body. So when you get your needs met, anxiety drops down and your sense of well-being comes back. When you don't get your need met, like i.e. not being in pain, why you become trapped and angry. So then your adrenaline levels really elevate, and then your body systems really respond, And things like irritable bowel, spastic bladder, migraine, headaches, all these are other symptoms of an adrenalized nervous system along with cortisol. So really what happens is that the symptoms we get are simply the body's physiological reaction to stress. Then additionally, what humans have, which is good news and bad news, is that we can think. So in addition to real threats, like air, food, and water, we actually have thoughts that create the exact same chemical response in the body, and that's where we get all these symptoms. The problem with chronic pain, of course, pain really signals danger, and so your body's adrenaline instantly goes up, which of course magnifies the pain signal. So more pain, more anxiety, more pain. If you get this loop going, that's pretty deadly. So anxiety, in my perspective, is a neurological issue. It gets stronger as you get older. It's like an athlete learning a skill. And you get these pathways burned into your brain that become permanent. And you can't fix them. And they are permanent, ingrained, etched in pathways that cannot be fixed. And once you understand it, that you can't fix them, in fact, the more attention you pay to these things, the worse it gets.
So wait a second. So hold on one second. So the more, the older we get, the more anxiety is hard to overcome. Because I wonder if, you know, all my girlfriends who are in their 40s and 50s and 60s are like, oh my God, life's so much easier. I don't care so much. But really, they do have more health problems, like, oh, my knee hurts all the time, or, oh, I have to have shoulder surgery, you know. And so the brain actually gets used to anxiety and then just starts functioning at that level?
Well, what happens is that it's the adrenaline, really, that causes the problem. So when you're anxious, your body secretes adrenaline, which does a bunch of things. It shuts down the blood supply to your brain. It actually increases your heart rate and shuts down the blood supply to your gut. So it's interesting that you pointed out that your girlfriends have different other symptoms, because it's been clearly pointed out that if you're not connected to your anxiety, another body part will act up. So we can shut off anxiety. I mean, that was my problem, by the way. I mean, I do the most complex spine surgery that exists. I did not become a major spine surgeon by having anxiety, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't even know what it was until my first symptom that I had anxiety was when I was 4 years old. I was driving across the bridge at night in Seattle, Washington, and I had a panic attack. I'm going, what's this? So I honestly, if you told me that I had anxiety up until that moment, I would have said, you're out of your mind. I'm a spine surgeon. I can do this. I'm tough. I'm resilient. And so this story we develop around ourselves is really intense. We call it dissociating, where I had a very abusive background, but I just blew it off. I just shut the door at age 15 and moved on. But guess what? All those behavioral patterns are established right around age 4 or 5 years old before your conscious brain even kicks into gear. And then when your conscious brain kicks into gear, the unconscious brain processes approximately 1 million times more information per second in your conscious brain. That's why people don't get New Year's resolutions. That's why the rational brain cannot win over the unconscious brain. You just can't do it.
It's so strong. And we're not even really aware of how it's running the show.
Correct.
Got it.
Because it's our norm.
Yeah, I suffered from chronic migraines for a long time, and I changed something in my life where, you know, I basically left working at the tea company because it was so stressful after a while. I didn't want to have to argue with distributors and grocery stores anymore. I felt like I wasn't in my highest good anymore by pushing paper, and I left the company, and it was remarkable that the migraines went away basically within a month, and I've maybe had two in 2 years. And so I think you're absolutely right. I thought it was maybe the meds I was taking, or I thought maybe, but when I got rid of all of that, they were still gone. So I completely agree. So what can people do? You found it at 40, it came back. And what did you then do to actually start controlling or managing the subconscious so that it didn't run your life?
So this is a tricky answer, so let me try to be clear here. So I actually experienced anxiety for the first time at age 40. I honestly did not know what anxiety was until age 40. So what happened the next 13 years, the wheels came off. So I developed a full-blown obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is the ultimate anxiety disorder.
Got it.
And that's repetitive, intrusive thoughts that don't stop. And really not a very treatable problem. So it became extreme over the next 13 years. And I would say some of those were just awful. So what happened by accident, I picked up a book that talked about these expressive writing exercises. We said, write down exactly what you're thinking. And I tended to throw them away because they're pretty intense. And what inadvertently that did is that it separates you from these circuits. In other words, you can't solve them, but you can separate, shift, and reprogram.
So you did it through writing. You did that through journaling?
Correct. And I tried everything. For 13 years, I went to psychotherapy, medication, seminars, self-help books, meditation, you name it. And the data, which I just found out about 6 months ago, there's over 55 research papers documenting the effectiveness of expressive writing. It's unbelievable.
Well, as a writer, I just have to say, yes, that's great.
it's interesting. It's unbelievable. And so there's something about, and I'm not a neuroscientist, so here's my orthopedic explanation of this, is I think that you're connecting with vision and feel, both of which go to the unconscious part of the brain. And once you understand that these circuits of being a victim and sorry for yourself and whatever you want to put into that negative bucket is a permanent pathway. And when you're talking to I'm all over psychiatry. I think it's wonderful. Psychologists, it's wonderful. But if you're trying to analyze and fix the past, it's done. You cannot do that. So essentially, the only goal of the project in an odd way, there's actually no goal. There's no end point. There's no beginning point because the only objective of the entire project is this conversation right here. In other words, right now. So what the writing does is sort of separates you from this noise in your head. And then I have a little exercise called active meditation, which people would call mindfulness. And mine is maybe just a slight variation on that. I'm not going to take credit for this. But, you know, you simply put your brain on sensory input. And so with the writing, you become aware of what's in there, and you've separated, and that space is now connected to vision and feel, and that goes to the unconscious part of the brain. Then the act of meditation, as I'm talking to you, I'm just feeling the back, this is me talking to you right this second. So when your brain's on sensory input, that's where your nervous system is.
Got it.
So there's many layers to the project, but I now get people saying, look, start the writing, deliberate active meditation, and that's the starting point.
So what do you give them writing prompts? My writing coach, Deb Norton, is working on a book that I'm hoping to publish, and she is the queen of writing prompts, and she tells you to write for 5 minutes without lifting your pen. What's the practice of writing that you have your patients do?
Well, I use the word expressive writing. It's basically write down exactly how you feel, whether it's grandiose, delusional, negative, depressed, angry, whatever it is. Simply get the emotions on paper that you're feeling. Mm. And unfortunately, the way the brain works, we generally have more negative thoughts than positive thoughts. And so what happens is you get those on paper, you become aware of what's there. And then, again, the process of reprogramming is awareness, detachment, reprogramming. So you become aware of the negativity, and you've separated. And then the positive substitution could be art, music, mindfulness, acupuncture, you name it. Those are the things that get substituted back in. So positive thinking doesn't really work, but positive substitution is actually critical.
Okay, so I think
positive substitution process.
Okay, you just nailed something that I've never been able to put words to in basically. So you separate from the pain and you look at it, so you've got perspective, and then you go and you do something positive in its place. And it's active. That's what I think a lot of people don't realize is that the activity, the positive activity, because everybody says, well, I try to be a positive thinker, but thinking is almost passive. It's almost like your body needs to move towards something pleasurable or positive in order for it to, replace the negativity. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, there's two things that happen with positive thinking. The first one is that, first of all, you're using the rational brain to deal with the irrational unconscious brain. So it's a mismatch. And second of all, positive thinking in some ways is just another way of suppressing negative thinking. And of course, we try not to think about something, you think about it more. And they've demonstrated in several experiments, we try not to think about something, not only do you think about it more, you think about it a lot more.
Don't think about how much weight you put on. Don't think about how much weight you put on.
Right. So what happens inadvertently, if you think in terms of neurological pathways, you know, you take some crazy random thought. And this came out of Harvard. Dr. Wagner wrote an article in 1987 called Paradoxical Effects of Thought Suppression. they did a brilliant little experiment that's nicknamed White Bears, and he asked them not to think about white bears. And to summarize the experiment is that they thought about it a lot more, but he also wrote an essay called The Seed of Our Own Undoing. His point being, the more of a well-intentioned, upright person you are, wanting to do good in the world, the higher the chances you're going to take yourself down, because a positive, well-intentioned person has a higher chance of suppressing negative thoughts. A negative, dark person doesn't suppress as much. They just sort of act out a lot of the time. So it's the people that potentially have the most to contribute are the ones that are taken out of the game by about age 40 or 50 years old.
Called
indeed,
burnout.
If you look at history,
it's burnout.
And burnout is progressive anxiety, plain and simple. I mean, what happens is that this anxiety becomes overwhelming because you have some crazy thought 20 years ago that, of course, means nothing. You put it aside, it comes back, you put it aside again, and over 20 to 30 years, it's like a parasite growing in your brain. It just gets larger and larger and larger. But remember, it means nothing. So now you're talking to psychiatrists about who you're not because you want to suppress it in the first place. But it's also like talking to psychiatrists about riding a bicycle. It's not going to change. So once you understand that these are just thoughts, and if even the smallest percent of the billions, even trillions of connections in the brain are sort of bizarre, every human being, by the way, goes through this. There is no exception in the human condition, period. And we spend a huge amount of time trying to cover that fact up. Every person gets to go through this. And some people, it's a whole different conversation about how people do this, but every human being has crazy thoughts in their brain just by definition, because the brain works by association. So you get some crazy associations in there that are sort of random. And again, by tossing those aside, you just gave them power.
So what do you do with them? Do you just watch them pass?
Well, an expert meditator can do that. I mean, I have all the respect in the world for very expert meditators. And they'll tell you, you watch your thoughts come in, you watch them go away, you learn not to react to these thoughts. So that's a very powerful process.
Yeah, I do that. But I also find that when I mean, what you're saying is so true. Like when I'm holding on to a resentment or a frustration, and I keep thinking like, okay, I don't want this to be in my mind because I don't want to be negative. I want to be positive. I want to do great things in the world. But that thought keeps coming back. What can I do with that thought? So do I write about it and then run out and get acupuncture? Or
So that's the perfect question, by the way. And that's the essence of this entire conversation, is that exact situation. So you take that exact thought and you write down the exact thought. You can write about it if you want in addition, but write down the exact thought that you're trying to suppress. And for some reason, it breaks up the cycle. I don't know what exactly happens. It's very, very consistent. But every person that's gotten better has actually started with a negative writing. And the reason why you're tearing up a piece of paper is not to get rid of the thought, because it's always there. That circuit is always there. It's a separation process. What Dr. Wagner pointed out in this article in 1987 is that the darker the thought that you can get on paper, the more powerful the process. People tend to identify their thoughts because if you have a negative thought, your body chemically reacts. So it feels like the thought is real.
Yeah.
It's not. It's just a thought.
Got it.
But it's a chemical reaction that cements the thought in your nervous system. Well, first of all, I don't believe the mind and body are separate at all.
The mind is in the body. It kind of runs things. So the mind and the body. So, for instance, I have a friend who has gone through a gnarly divorce, and it's very difficult for her to – like when we have conversations, she really is trying to be positive, like, oh, it doesn't bother me at all, or oh, he's just a kid, or oh, but then you can feel that she's still really hurt over it. And then I have a friend who's gone through, you know, a big legal fiasco, and he's really hurt from it. So if the negative thought comes up, like, oh my God, I had this terrible divorce, it's I've got to write it down. You write it down. And then it comes up again. You write it down again. And then it comes up again. You write it down again. So do you just keep writing it down so that it's almost like you're purging it as you write it until it stops coming up?
Nope. So the hardest part about this model is those circuits are permanent. In other words, the anguish she feels is there permanently. So 10 years from now, something could actually trigger that same response. But what happens is I have people write maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes in the morning and at night, just twice a day.
Got it.
Some people, if you overwrite is actually counterproductive because it's like you're trying to capture and control the thoughts. So it's just a separation process. It gives you a little bit of space in your mind to take the deep breath and just feel, listen, enjoy conversation.
That's great.
Whatever it is. And as you program into a new alternative, your brain actually starts to physically change. One of the metaphors that I use is that of a river that you want to divert into a different channel, and you start to do a little bit of a canal course, it starts filling up. And pretty soon the flow of the river actually starts to actually make the channel bigger. So eventually, as you put your nervous system into a different set of circuits, not only do the pain circuits drop down, but anxiety drops, anger drops, adrenaline loss. And there's over 30 symptoms that occur with an adrenalized nervous system. And I have 16 of those at the same time in my worst part of my deal, and they're gone. Now, if I quit doing my own writing, within about 2 to 3 weeks, my symptoms come back.
Wow.
So my ears will start to ring, my feet will start to burn, these little rashes will pop up here and there. And so sometimes the bodily sensations will come back even before I realize I'm anxious or stressed.
Wow.
And I'm going through a little bit right now. I have lots of stress on my plate, a lot going on. And I handle stress 10 times better than I did 10 years ago, but all of a sudden some physical symptoms are coming back. So I'm not feeling anxious. I'm actually not feeling frustrated. But guess what? My feet are burning.
Interesting.
So that's interesting. So, yeah, your body just becomes a feedback loop. And as you become aware of your connection to your body and vice versa, why you start to change things. But you become much more responsive to your environment.
Hey, Changemakers. I have a new sponsor, and I'm very excited about them. It's Harry's.com. I know it doesn't sound like something that I would go for, but I approve all my sponsors. And I really like Harry's.com because it's a shaving kit that you get once a month. If you don't need it, you can just say, I don't need it. And then you don't get it until you tell them you need it again. But basically, it's this gorgeous, it looks like a gift. It shows up in a little box. It's a razor kit and a paraben-free, really lovely essential oil-based shaving cream, and it comes with these 5-blade razors that are spectacular. I mean, my legs are super smooth. My husband has used them. He loves them. He can't believe it's so inexpensive. And what we found out was Harry's.com, they decided to cut out the middlemen. So you're not paying the drugstore's rent to go buy your razors every month. They come directly from an awesome factory that Harry's.com built or bought in Germany. So it's very precision and the package is beautiful. I'm buying them for my brothers and my dad and everybody for only $10. With this special deal, you can get a month's worth of shaving. It's $5 off. So I want you all to rush out online and go to Harry's.com and order your shaving kit. You can order it for your friends, for your husband, for your partner, for anyone you know who loves the art of shaving and loves having smooth skin, especially with summer coming up. So go to Harry's.com and enter my code ZHENA at checkout and get $5 off your first order of a starter set. With my code ZHENA, you can get a month's worth of shaving for just $10. That's Harry's.com, code Zena, ZHENA at checkout. And it really helps you change the way you shave forever. I'm a believer. I love it. I am reordering next month, and I can't wait to hear what you guys think. And the fact that they're helping pay for this podcast just makes them all that much cooler. So show your support, run out, spend $10, get a month's worth of shaving, and you will be very glad you did. Thanks, Changemakers.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zena Musica.
So I've kept a journal since I was a little girl. I have stacks and stacks and stacks of journals. And the writers that are turning my book into a show right now are, they have them all, and they're going to just take all the dark, dreary, terrible stuff and make a great show out of it. but it's an interesting thing because I do think, you know, when we go through abuse, when we go through all that, we are actually experiencing a story. and our lives are just one big story. And so when you say you change the story, so you write it down and then you go into, and I don't mean to harp on you on this, I really want my listeners to get what to do next. So they journal and then are they able to rewrite the story, or they just are getting it out and then they move on and shift tides, if you will, into a positive habit of sorts. Is that what you suggest?
Well, there's really three parts of getting better. So the writing is just the foundation, by the way. So the three parts of chronic pain are that you simply have to learn about chronic pain. It actually lives in a different part of the brain. And the other thing that's really critical to understand, that we look at mental pain and physical pain as the same thing. In other words, they actually are processed in the same part of the brain. So we look at anxiety, anger, and pain as all the same thing. So when pain drops, anxiety drops. When anxiety drops, pain drops. So the first thing to do is to simply understand how the nervous system works, understand neuroplasticity, how you can change the brain. Mm-hmm. The second part is you have to deal with every aspect at the same time. There's a bunch of things that affect, I'll use the word anxiety for this conversation, or chronic pain, is sleep. Sleep's a big deal.
Oh, God. Since Mia came into our lives, you know, she's not a big sleeper, and it's been really challenging.
Right. So let's say you're doing the writing exercises, which, by the way, do help you sleep. I mean, probably the most writing I do is when I wake up in the middle of the night. The only thing that actually puts me back to sleep is the negative writing. Mm. But everybody's different in this. So everybody does this differently. So what we're talking about today is mostly the stress management. Sleep's number one. The second part of the whole stress part that we're talking about. The third thing is physical conditioning. And you mentioned the weight room earlier, but I try to get every human being, but particularly my pain patients, into the weight room, because not only does it increase blood supply to the muscles, it helps increase the strength of cores, but there's also a neurological substitution process that takes place. You're actually substituting new impulses in the place of pain impulses.
So weightlifting actually can help shift your pain into, is that what you're saying? Like weightlifting is actually one of those, great.
Right, because you're giving bodily sensations back to the brain. Mm. A lot of time from the same part of the body that's painful, right? Mm-hmm. So now you're substituting, you know, light weights, high repetitions, gradually increasing that. And there's something that happens, I'm sure there's endorphins come into play also, a sense of well-being, being outside, in the gym with other people, et cetera. So I really try to get people into a health club, into the gym. I don't like people working out at home. I think that's a bit of a problem.
I have bought so much. Oh, yeah. I've bought so much equipment and had to get rid of all of it because I going to the gym is the best thing for me.
Right. I think weight training equipment at home actually just makes you feel guilty. Counterproductive. So I really try to get people into the health club. But the other thing is medications temporarily actually are important. I mean, for mm-hmm. when you're totally inundated with anxiety, you know, at least for 3-6 months, you need anti-anxiety medications. Or with sleep, if you're not sleeping in chronic pain, you probably need medications. But the final thing, which is really critical, is the is life outlook. And the part that maybe we can talk about in a little bit more detail is that the negative writing and the active meditation is sort of the core concept. But the thing that really adrenalizes your nervous system, decreases the blood supply to your brain, and people are not going to like to hear this, but it's been documented in several studies that in chronic pain, your brain actually physically shrinks. And when you treat chronic pain, it actually physically re-expands.
Wow.
So the key process, and people cannot get better without this step, is true, deep forgiveness. And there's a book that came into my practice about 6 or 7 years ago called Forgive for Good by Dr. Fred Luskin out of Stanford. And that book, that's when people started to go to pain-free. And in my own process, not only was I not connected to anxiety, I absolutely was not connected to anger. And I actually thought I was pretty cool. I actually thought I did not have anger issues. I was great. Nothing bothered me.
Teflon.
Incredibly, I was cool. And guess what? Not so cool.
Yeah.
When that came out, it was tough, but within 6 weeks, that's when my symptoms started to disappear. So if you look at anxiety and anger, it's the same thing. Remember, anger is loss of control, mm-hmm. and what causes the need for control is anxiety, is that when you have that adrenalized nervous system, the blood supply to your brain actually shuts down. You can't think clearly. And of course, your body's organ systems are really responding. So the key issue in this whole process is forgiveness. And if people cannot let go of the true wounds that are there, what Dr. Luskin points out, he did four major research projects, and two of them were with the parents of children who had been murdered. So not only do these people, not only do you rightfully despise these people, they now own you, right? I mean, you're consumed with hate.
Well, you're the one carrying it around, not them.
Right. Right. And so his point is that forgiveness is actually a very selfish move, but it's critical. And the problem with chronic pain is that you are legitimately suffering, and you have to truly, deeply let it go. I mean, often a person really did injure you, car accident, bad surgeon, whatever it is, and you have a very legitimate problem. But again, you're the only one that's suffering. Mm. So Dr. Luskin and myself and my wife, by the way, do a seminar every summer at the Omega Institute in New York.
I know. I'm looking at my calendar. I'm wanting to go.
Well, the essence of the seminar is that there's structure, there's hope, there's people that have done well that are there. And of the 30 people that I've gone through, probably 20 of them are still pain-free, you know, after a year or two. So it's a remarkable week. It's very enjoyable. There's lots of companionship, lots of structure, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, let's go back to forgiveness. I think this is such a big one. I think that we are living in a world where there's a lot of resentment and a lot of anger toward each other. I mean, our political system, it's embarrassing to me seeing how much the two parties fight and argue, and there's so much conflict all the time. And, you know, also with the Middle East, it's like nobody can just sit down at a table, forgive one another, and move on and make peace. We're living in a world that is completely disconnected to forgiveness. So can you give me some tools? I use metta meditation, where I basically beam love at the people I need to forgive, you know, and it is hard, I have to say. You know, the first, I'll do it for 30 solid days if I need to forgive somebody. And the first few days, I'm just like beaming love at this person that I want to sock in the face. So it's like, it's hard, but I have to say it has helped me so much. So can you give us some tips about forgiveness?
Well, first of all, I think that's where the negative writing comes in a huge way. I mean, I think you get it out on paper how you feel. This is exactly how you feel, how you really despise this person. And remember, the goal is not to like this person. That is not the goal of forgiveness. The goal of forgiveness is that you eventually understand that they acted the way they did because they're the ones suffering also. Mm-hmm. You actually, in an odd way, actually develop compassion for that person who did the bad deed, but you don't have to like them at all. That's not the goal. So as you understand, these persons are, maybe they're mentally ill, maybe they have a horrible abusive background, they have reasons for doing what they're doing, you still don't have to like them at all. So what happens is that you understand that they're suffering also badly, which is probably why they did the bad deed in the first place. Develop a compassion for them that can be pretty deep, by the way. I mean, I eventually had an extraordinarily psychotic, abusive mother, and I still don't like what she did. I don't even like her. I mean, I understand, I have deep compassion for her. She passed away never, ever living in the light. I mean, she lived a very dark life.
Yeah.
And she abused every person in her family to beyond description. So that is what it is. So what happens is that you now get to enjoy the person right in front of you that you do like. You get to actually connect with your kids. Mm-hmm. Your body's not adrenalized. And so as you let the past go, you actually get to totally engage in the current moment. That's the goal. And there's, you know, Dr. Luskin puts different tools in the book that we, for instance, do what's called belly breathing.
Yeah.
Whereas your body's adrenalized, and when you do a belly breathing exercise, it's basically felt to stimulate the vagus nerve, which is the parasympathetic nervous system, as opposed to the sympathetic nervous system that is very stimulated with adrenaline. So what you're doing, you start calming down your heart rate, relaxing your muscles, and simply pulling yourself into the present moment. Because the process, again, the past is permanent, the circuits to the past is permanent. And as you understand that, it's simply connect with the moment in front of you. And again, going to our earlier part of the conversation, the only goal or non-goal of the project is this conversation right here and right now.
Absolutely.
So what somebody did to you 5 years ago actually doesn't have to come into this conversation.
Yeah. And I like to, you know, when I'm doing my meta over, you know, I've found it that the more I forgave people in my past and my childhood, and even, you know, I was carrying my family's concentration camp survivors. So I found that there was forgiveness that went back generations. And I didn't even realize that with, you know, and I, because I was bullied as a kid. And then for some reason, I kept recreating that bully experience in my life. And I'm a big Diamond Cutter fan. It's my Bible, basically. It's a book called The Diamond Cutter. And it talks about how you can end the cycle of being bullied is to stop being angry over it. So it is right. To basically just stop the cycle of anger and then come into forgiveness. And so I found that once I started forgiving, you know, the immediate, it started to go all down my family history. And I also realized that was when my migraines went away. That was when a lot of, you know, I had an ulcer, I had migraines, all those things. But I want to talk a little bit too, because I really believe we're addicted to adrenaline. I watch people get hyped up in business, and I watch people, and I think that we get such a jolt from the adrenaline that we get high off of it and we become junkies. Does that have any truth in your practice?
Well, I mean, I think that in medicine, unfortunately, is that we're perfectionists and we're always driving ourselves, and we're always you know, if you think about it, perfectionism is the ultimate victim role. So I think that the answer is absolutely.
How is that? How is perfectionism the ultimate victim role?
So I have a little genealogy of anger. I talked about whether you have a situation that you blame, mm-hmm. then you're a victim, and then you're angry. Mm-hmm. So this perceived victimhood, where somebody called you a name or they didn't invite you to a party, et cetera. So that's perceived victimhood. You know, real victimhood is somebody actually takes your money, robs you, assaults you, et cetera. But there's still a circumstance that you blame, that you're a victim, then you're angry. So at the end of the day, whether it's perceived victimhood or real victimhood, why you're angry. And the problem with perfectionism is that it's unattainable. So I think going back to your concept about adrenaline being addicting, I think it's being a victim that's addicting, which obviously the chemical reaction is part of it. But being a victim is a very, very powerful role, and people cannot give it up. By far and away, the biggest obstacle I have in this whole project is people actually being open to an engagement. So with perfectionism, things are never perfect. And so you're a victim of less than perfect. And you can blame lack of perfect, and then you're always angry.
That's such a good point.
I think the reason why people are perfectionists is that they can't give up the victim role. In other words, if everything is perfect, then they can always go to perfectionism, right?
Yeah. But perfect is impossible. And so I love this. I absolutely, you know, everything that comes out of your mouth really speaks to the wisdom of, you know, the Buddhism I study and everything, but you're a modern day surgeon. And I am so grateful that the ancient wisdom is being brought forth today in medicine through people like you. I mean, have you had any resistance? Has there ever, I mean, tell me a little bit about how this has played into your practice.
Well, in my own practice, it's been literally a miracle. I mean, I spent 7 years being an aggressive surgeon, and then in 1993, I stopped doing surgery for back pain. But I didn't know what to do. So starting in 2006, we started sharing these tools, and most physicians, almost to the person, really dislike treating chronic pain because they don't know what to do. It's not that they dislike the patients, but they're frustrated. So they're almost as frustrated as their patients, and that would include myself. So I've given several lectures, one at the Mayo Clinic 2 years ago, where I gave a lecture called Enjoying the Management of Chronic Pain. And what we're doing is to treat people's sleep, treat the anxiety with the tools we talked about, we adjust medications, we work on forgiveness, and I now have 40 patients that I'm writing a research paper on with major structural surgical lesions that have gone pain-free without the surgery. So it's absolutely transformed my practice, and when we do the operations, the good results are better. We have very few surgical failures, and the ones that are difficult failures are the ones that haven't gone through the process. So about 3 years ago, we simply said, look, we're simply not going to do elective surgery unless we have these unless we have sleep under control, anxiety under control, et cetera. So it's absolutely transformed my practice. Unfortunately, medicine is not really like this very much. I've actually been told.
Yeah, you're going to put them out of business.
Well, the reality is this is crazy, but I'm actually slightly panicked about what to do. I mean, 40 surgeries is a lot of surgeries not to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's actually become very challenging generating a living as a surgeon, to be honest with you.
That doesn't do surgery? Yeah, I would imagine.
And then also people are doing this as self-directed. I mean, it doesn't require injections and stimulators and all sorts of stuff. And so, you know, it's a self-directed process. It's structured and it's self-directed. So the physicians become coaches and guides and cheerleaders. And I have about 7 of us on campus now that are doing this. We're having the best time.
So, yeah, but the money, I think that what you were saying too is that how does a surgeon who's not performing surgery and helping people self-direct their healing make change in the medical industry to where you guys can actually still make a living as well? That's a big question. Right. The podcast is called Changemaker, and obviously you're here because you are a beacon of change, but tell me what that looks like from your point of view, because that's got to be a little scary.
Well, I mean, I don't want to get too negative here, but right now I see 2 to 4 patients every day that have had major surgeries done on normal spines. And the results of a failed spine surgery are devastating, and the suffering is devastating. I just can't put it into words. So that's why I'm so committed on this project, because I'm seeing people actively being hurt, having major surgeries done on normal spines. And I see people with 5, 10, 15, 20 operations over 15 or 20 years. It's unbelievable having an entire life taken away with spine surgery. So it's really tough. And the bottom line is there is too many spine surgeons. There's probably 60% of spine surgeries being conservative that should not be done. Wow. And right now there's over $11 billion being spent on spine surgery every year. The data for the surgery is almost zero. There's almost no data showing that we should be doing these operations. And I think hopefully I was clear enough today when I have the explanation that the body's under stress, it secretes adrenaline, and your body reacts. I don't think that's so hard.
Yeah.
The medical profession is not buy-in, period.
Interesting.
They just don't buy it. And so, they say, well, psychological, but wait a second. When your body has adrenaline and your heart is racing, is that imaginary? No. Is the body being adrenalized imaginary? No. Will you have migraine headaches because your blood vessels, you know, vasoconstrictive, vasodilated? Yes. So you just talk about the body's programmed physiological response to stress, and you're going to have symptoms. That's not psychological. It's a neurological reflex. So, no, the resistance I get in medicine is unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, because it's so what is the next step? How are you going to help the medical industry? I mean, is this something where you just put your nose down and focus on your patients and keep it going? Or is there a form of activism that you're taking out into the world? Because I have to say, when I met you through Beth and Beth was telling me about your work, then I bought your book and I gave it to my mom. And she was like, oh, my God, this makes so much sense. I can't believe it, because she had spine surgery to the point where they actually they burned her nerves off so that she wouldn't feel the pain anymore. And it put her in way more pain because she was angry they did that. You know, it was, and she's starting to see, oh, this is anger. I get it. I can't believe it. So what do you do now in the medical world? Do you go out and try to get buy-in, or what does this look like?
Well, first of all, I don't want to come across as negative in the medical profession.
No.
We're not trained this way.
No, so, Western medicine saved my son's life. I'm a big believer in all of it, but there's a balance here.
Right. So I give lectures. So no, I'm in an extremely motivated mode to be out, create a movement. Basically, my goal is to eliminate chronic pain.
Yeah,
and you know, I'm actually going to the school systems, trying to pull these tools right into preschool and first grade onwards. That's a big step. I give lectures all over the country to medical physicians, who are very open, by the way. I mean, they're very excited about this process. And so, I gave a lecture in Billingham, Washington, about 3 weeks ago, to over 100 primary care physicians, and the response just was overwhelmingly positive. So I think physicians are ready for this stuff, and it needs to go right into the medical school curriculum. I'm going to a meeting in London next month with a think tank of people, I think, like myself, to try to get this out there. I'm thinking about putting a textbook together on my body syndrome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, my total commitment is to get this out into mainstream medicine and into the public's
Well, it's needed. It's needed. I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing and the courage it takes to, you know, be a change maker in the medical industry where, you know, a lot of people are, you know, they only see what they see. And so you're quite a visionary in the medical world. And I really appreciate what you're doing. And thank you for helping my mom through your book. And
yeah, very excited about it. And by the way, that is what keeps me going. When I hear stories like that, I get so excited. I mean, I mean really, I mean, that's the end of the day. I'm trying to change the world. You know, I just love that one patient I hear about one at a time is just doing great. I mean, that is why I do this.
Absolutely. And thank you for being a change maker. And for our listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. You can find out more about Dr. David Hanscom at Back in Control. Well, it's actually not the website, but his book is called Back in Control, and his website is drdavidhanscom. Hanscom is spelled HANSCOM.com. The book is absolutely fantastic. It's called Back in Control. Dr. Hanscom is a great leader. His course at the Omega Institute is in July of this year. So if you guys are, you know, curious and want to go and heal from chronic pain, check out the Omega, eomega.org, and it's under the workshop. So thank you so much, change makers. Go out into the world and make change. And I will see you next week.